We're back. And we ended our last lecture by examining a particular feature of Kant's moral philosophy that sort of entails that whenever we behave immorally, we're essentially cheating, right? And this is not to say that we're literally cheating, but that that immoral behavior will take the form of cheating. And what I suggested, of course, was that this is essentially an instance where human beings try to make exceptions of themselves, right? A situation wherein I want you to keep the rules while I take advantage of breaking them. And I suggested that, you know, lying tends to have this feature, right? Such that, you know, in a world where everyone were to tell lies, it would be very difficult to get away with lying. And in fact, lying might become superfluous altogether. People would simply anticipate that I'm going to lie, in which case I couldn't gain anything by lying. And so Kant seems to believe that what this entails is that immorality often will take the form of cheating. And whenever I find myself cheating in this particular way, that is to say, whenever I find myself making an exception of myself, then I ought to be very suspicious of my motivations, right? And I ought to seek more virtuous motivations. And so that's what Kant's recommendation is, right? Be careful whenever you think you're in an exception case, because morality does not admit of exception cases, right? Morality is categorical and not hypothetical for Kant, right? So exceptions won't be easily found, unlike for utilitarianism. Okay, one of the ways Kant is sometimes misunderstood, he's sometimes taken to be saying that essentially morality requires us to all behave in the same way, right? But this is a very gross misunderstanding of what Kant has in mind, right? So, you know, one of the questions we might ask is this: is it really true that everyone has reason to do the same thing, right? Will the categorical imperative make it such that our choices become so narrow that we all end up doing the same types of things? Well, again, as I suggested already, this is a gross misunderstanding of Kant's intentions. And it really stems from a misunderstanding of the distinction between hypothetical and categorical imperatives, which I went into a couple of lectures ago, I guess in lecture 8. Or no, I guess maybe in lecture 9, our last lecture. At any rate, here's how we want to think about it. We've already talked about maxims and how we might develop maxims, and unfortunately Kant doesn't really have a whole lot to say about how we should go about constructing maxims. I told you that maxims are essentially principles of action, right? That undergird our actions, right? They're the reasons we have for performing a given action, right? Or, variously, we could say that a maxim is simply a first-person statement of intention, right? So, here's a maxim. I will call Linda Smith. Right? Now, you might wonder, who is Linda Smith, right? And why should I call her? Well, if I were to push this kind of maxim through the formula of universal law, right, and I were to ask, you know, can this maxim become a universal law? The very interesting question is whether it would pass the formula of universal law or not. Now, I want to set that question aside until a little later and focus simply on this idea that I should call Linda Smith. And of course, immediately we ask ourselves, well, who is Linda Smith and why should I call her? And, you know, if I have no relation at all to Linda Smith, it won't make sense for me to call her at all, right? So what we want to say is that maxims, or in other words, the reasons I have for behaving in any particular way, have to be grounded in the conditions in which I find myself, right? And you'll see this as we explore some of the examples that Kant provides himself. You'll see this very plainly, that maxims must be grounded in the conditions in which we find ourselves. Otherwise, nothing that the categorical imperative recommends will make sense for our lives, right? And in fact, the categorical imperative will be a kind of epiphenomenon. Epiphenomenon is simply something that doesn't really touch upon our lives, right? It just sort of rides above our experiences. So the categorical imperative has to touch us, be able to come down, so to speak, and actually meet us in the particular conditions in which we find ourselves, right? So, and the way I do that is by constructing maxims that are grounded in the particular conditions in which I find myself. So who is Linda Smith? Well, Linda Smith might be my mother. And of course, if Linda Smith is my mother, then I might have reason to call her, right? And all of those factors are relevant as I'm constructing a maxim and as I'm considering whether or not I should call Linda Smith, and whether or not I might have an obligation to call Linda Smith. So, and like I said earlier, Kant is sometimes misunderstood as denying that those particular conditions in which we find ourselves are at all relevant. Of course, you know, and as I said earlier, this is really develops out of a misunderstanding of the relationship between hypothetical and categorical imperatives. If you're interested in this issue, there's a great paper by someone named Marcus Singer, not Peter Singer, but Marcus Singer. Marcus Singer argues that you know, the categorical imperative, that in fact that Kant himself may have misunderstood the implications of his own theory. You know, so Kant provides us with a framework and then misapplies that framework. And you know, which is sort of developed into a sort of almost a global misunderstanding of Kant's intentions, which is really unfortunate, because I think, to be honest, I think Kant's moral philosophy is quite incredible, systematically coherent. So I find it very compelling. Not to say that I'm a Kantian necessarily, although I probably lean toward Kant rather than utilitarianism. So, at any rate, let's leave that issue aside, but notice, let me give you one more example of a maxim. You know, so if you like pizza, you might want to order pizza. But of course, if you don't like pizza, then you wouldn't want to order pizza, right? And so sometimes Kant is taken as saying, you know, that we all have reason to do the same thing, right? Such that if a maxim passes the formula of universal law, then we all must obey that maxim. But that's not at all what Kant is suggesting. Right? First of all, I have to meet given conditions, right? Conditions that are relevant to the situations that I face on a daily basis, right? So we might say this, that a maxim will take this form, right? The form of a conditional, right? An if-then statement. So if I satisfy condition P, then I ought to do Q. Similarly, if I satisfy conditions P and R, then I ought to do T, right? So it's a matter of, you know, what conditions my life satisfies, and then sort of carving out a place for me to occupy in a moral sense, right? And those conditions will always be relevant. So rather than going with this gross misunderstanding, as I've called it, Kant never intended, it seems to me. Well, he may have intended. It's very hard to say. But we need not interpret Kant in that way, right? We need not interpret Kant as saying that the conditions in which we find ourselves are morally irrelevant. It seems to me that they're extremely relevant as we confront questions that might call upon us to behave in particular ways. So we can't ignore the conditions under which we find ourselves. Right? Maxims will always be grounded in the particular conditions in which we find ourselves. Now, what Kant does say is that the categorical imperative itself has to be derived from reason alone. Right? It can't depend upon any of the particular conditions in which we find ourselves. Right? And I know I've said that phrase over and over. So the categorical imperative itself, you remember that we derive the categorical imperative from autonomy, right? And we derived autonomy from our conceptions of rationality. And of course, rationality itself was developed from Kant's conception of freedom, right? And all of that was done all of it was done a priori, right? This is a term that Kant uses frequently. A priori means from reason alone, basically, and not from experience, right? So a priori means without experience, which means without looking at the particular conditions in which I find myself. Right? So I'm not grounding morality in experience. Instead, I'm grounding morality in reason alone, right? Apart from experience. And that's essentially where the categorical imperative comes from. Okay, so where does that leave us? Well, let me ask a few questions, and just to see whether or not you can answer them. Now, of course, you can't answer them in a traditional sense, but I want you to ponder these questions. You even may want to stop the recording and just think about them for just a moment. Here's the first question. Do I have to act on all maxims that pass the formula of universal law? That's the question. Do I have to act on all maxims that pass the formula of universal law? Now, I've just, of course, described a number of scenarios, right, wherein you wouldn't have to act on every maxim that passed the formula of universal law, right? For example, if my maxim, called into Smith, were to pass the formula of universal law, the first question you're going to ask, as I said earlier, is, you know, who is Linda Smith and why should I call her? So you may have no reason to call Linda Smith. On the other hand, I may have every reason to call Linda Smith, right? So calling Linda Smith, again, is grounded in the particular conditions in which I find myself, right? And you're not necessarily obligated to call her, while I may be obligated to call her. So the answer, of course, is no. I don't have to act on all maxims that pass the formula of universal law, although I do have to limit myself to those maxims that pass the formula of universal law. Okay? So that's a very important distinction. I don't have to act on all maxims that pass, but I do have to limit myself to those maxims that pass. Okay? We aren't morally required to act on all maxims. Okay. So, where does that leave us now? Well, here's another issue. We might ask a question about maxims, and of course I told you that maxims are just reasons, right? Reasons we have for doing what we want to do. And we might be curious about what happens when a maxim fails. Does it follow from that that the action that I wanted to perform is also immoral? Right. So in other words, we have reasons for behaving in a particular way, or a motivation for behaving in a particular way, and then we have the action itself, right? So we have motivations and actions. Kant principally is testing motivations, right? The maxim is a kind of motivation. It's the intention behind an action. And Kant is most curious about whether or not our maxims or our intentions are worthy justifications for action, right? And he wants to know whether or not those motivations are valid motivations, right? Do they pass the formula of universal law? Now, if a maxim does not pass the formula of universal law, does that also entail that the action I wanted to perform is also immoral? Right? And it seems to me that the answer to this question will be no. Right? You can be motivated to do something that is good, but nevertheless be motivated by reasons that are less than worthy, right? So, for example, if I had a rich aunt and I wanted to spend a lot of time with her because I was hoping that, she would make me her benefactor in some sense, right? That I would inherit millions of dollars. And the only reason I wanted to spend any time with her at all was so that I could inherit this money. Well, that would be a less than worthy reason for spending time with my rich aunt, right? So, according to Kant's moral philosophy, right, I should re-examine the reasons I have for spending time with my aunt, right? And the categorical imperative would determine that those reasons are less than worthy reasons for spending time with my aunt, right? But nevertheless, spending time with my aunt is a good thing to do, right? Kant's example is one of a shopkeeper, right? Kant talks about a shopkeeper who always gives his customers the proper change when they come into his store. Of course, giving customers the proper change is a good thing to do, but the only reason the shopkeeper gives his customers the proper change is not because he respects them or not because he has a sense of his moral duty, it's because he doesn't want to lose their business, right? If he could find a way of keeping their business and yet cheat them, he would do that, right? And so Kant says this is a less worthy reason for giving your customers the proper change. What you ought to do is have a respect for them and give them the proper change out of respect for them, or out of respect for the moral law. Right? So in this case, we can have good actions performed for the wrong reasons. Right? And that should be very intuitive to you. In the same sense, we can have bad actions performed for the right reasons. Right? So we'll examine possibly some of those scenarios later. Let's see. Where does that leave us now? Okay. Here's the next question. How does the formula of universal law forbid an action? Right? Now, in this case, we're not talking about motivations, right? Remember, we've made a sharp distinction between a motivation to act in a particular way and the action itself, right? So we said there can be good actions, nevertheless performed for the wrong reasons, right? Bad reason, good action, and we can have the reverse of that. We can have good motivations, yet bad actions, right? So what would that look like? Well, let's return to that initial question, right? How does the formula of universal law forbid an action? Now, this is a tricky question, and most often students in a traditional class really struggle with this question. And I end up giving them the answer. And of course, in this setting, I have to give you the answer, because you're not here to respond in any way. Right? So how does the formula of universal law forbid an action? Well, look, the only way to forbid an action outright is to say that there are no justifications for performing that action whatsoever. Right? So in this case, we're talking about actions that are so heinous that we can't imagine that there could be any possible valid reason for performing them. Right? So here, think about something so terrible that there is no good reason for performing it, right? Maybe torturing babies, for example. No good reason to torture a baby, ever, right? Perhaps rape also falls into this category. There's never a good reason to rape someone, right? So that's something like what we're talking about, right? So the only way to forbid an action, given the formula of universal law, is to say that there are no good reasons for performing it. No maxims will pass the formula of universal law with respect to that action. Right? There are no good reasons for performing that action. Okay. Oh, let's see. Okay, where does that leave us now? Well, I want to talk about two ways that a maxim can fail the formula of universal law. In the first place, a maxim can fail the formula of universal law by committing itself to a contradiction in conception. Right? So there are contradictions in conception, right, which Kant tells us are violations of perfect duties. Right? Now, a perfect duty for Kant is something like a negative obligation. Okay, so what is a negative obligation? I know I'm going to run through this pretty quickly, but perhaps you can slow down and rewind and listen to it again. At any rate, so we're talking about contradictions in conception. This is the first way that a maxim can fail the formula of universal law. Right? It can lead to a contradiction in conception, in which case we want to say that it's immoral to proceed upon that maxim because it leads to a contradiction in conception. So what is a contradiction in conception? Well, we'll get to that in a minute. A contradiction in conception essentially is a violation of a perfect duty, which is also a violation of a negative obligation. Okay? Perfect duties are negative obligations. What's a negative obligation? Well, here's one. Don't lie. Right? That's a negative obligation. Don't break your promises. Right? Don't cheat. Don't steal. Those are all negative obligations. Right? Now, as I said earlier, they're perfect duties as well. Now, what Kant believes is that perfect duties do not admit of any exceptions whatsoever. Right? They are binding upon us all of the time. So anything that is a perfect duty must be followed, right? There are no exceptions. Contradictions in conception, okay? Now, the other way that a maxim can fail the formula of universal law is by leading to a contradiction in will. Excuse me. Okay, so contradiction in conception, now contradiction in will. So what is a contradiction in will? Well, unlike contradictions in conception, contradictions in will lead to what Kant calls violations of imperfect duties, right? Not a perfect duty, but an imperfect duty, which is a positive obligation. Okay? What would a positive obligation be? Well, it would be something like help the needy, right? Help the needy, or develop your talents, or something like that. Now, Kant believes we have obligations, right? We have obligations that are positive, that happen to be imperfect duties. So in other words, the way I go about fulfilling my imperfect duties is really up to me. How I meet those obligations is a matter of autonomy. Right? It's up to me. I'm free to sort of determine how I will meet those obligations. But with perfect duties, I'm not free to determine how I will meet those obligations. Right? They're more restrictive in some sense. Okay. So, that leaves us with two categories, right? The contradiction in conception and the contradiction in will. And a maxim can fail the formula of universal law by leading to either a contradiction in conception or a contradiction in will. So what I want to do now is look at a few passages from Kant's groundwork, and I'll essentially read these passages to you. And they're illustrations, right? Kant calls them illustrations, and he wants to show us just how the formula of universal law works. Okay, so let me turn to those. Okay. This first example that Kant provides, actually I'm going to read them out of order because I think the second example Kant provides is better than the first. But there are four in total, and I'll read them all out of order. But what I can say is this, that the first two examples that I will read will be examples of contradictions in conception, or at least what Kant believes lead to contradictions in conception. The first example is better than the second, and I'll explain why I think that's the case in a few minutes. But at any rate, the first example is about a man who needs money. Right, and he goes into a bank, or he approaches a friend. Those details aren't really specified, but at any rate, he wants to borrow money, either from a bank or perhaps from a friend, and he knows he doesn't have the ability to pay the money back, but he promises to pay the money back anyway. Right, and Kant wants to know whether this is moral or not. So let's take a look at the passage, and we'll try to determine just what it is that Kant is after. Okay, so here it is. He says this, another finds himself driven to borrowing money because of need. He well knows that he will not be able to pay it back, but he sees too that he will get no loan unless he makes a firm promise to pay it back within a fixed time. He is inclined to make such a promise, but he has still enough conscience to ask, is it not unlawful and contrary to duty to get out of difficulties in this way? Supposing, however, he did resolve to do so, the maxim of his action would run thus. Now, notice this maxim, the way Kant constructs this maxim. Right? He says this. So here's the maxim. Whenever I believe myself short of money, I will borrow money and promise to pay it back, though I know that this will never be done. Now, this principle of self-love, Kant continues, or personal advantage, is perhaps quite compatible with my own entire future welfare. Only there remains the question, is it right? I therefore transform the demand of self-love into a universal law, and frame my question thus. How would things stand if my maxim became a universal law? I then see straight away that this maxim can never rank as a universal law of nature and be self-consistent, but must necessarily contradict itself. For the universality of a law that everyone believing himself to be in need of can make any promise he pleases with the intention not to keep it would make promising, and the very purpose of promising, itself impossible, since no one would believe he was being promised anything, but would laugh at utterances of this kind as empty shams. Okay? Now, I know that's a long passage, but listen. This is, I mean, everything you need to know about Kant's moral philosophy is contained right here, right? at least as far as the formula of universal law is concerned. So our question is, we have a number of questions, I guess. Look, how does Kant construct a maxim? That's one question we could have, right? And he gives us an example of that. And how does Kant apply the formula of universal law, right? So again, the formula of universal law is simply a test by which I determine whether or not my maxim can be universalized, right? And when we talk about universalization, what we're really talking about is something like this, right? Could everyone act in the way that I want to act with the reasons that I have, right? And if it leads, if that idea, right? So what's essentially going on here? Well, look, whenever I have a maxim, I want to test my maxim by asking whether it can be universalized. And when I do that, when I universalize it, what I'm essentially doing is imagining a world in which everyone were acting the way I'm going to act with the reasons that I have, right? And if that leads to some kind of contradiction in conception or a contradiction in will, then I cannot perform the action with the reasons I have, right? Okay, so that's essentially what, that's all that Kant is after, right? So what does it mean to proceed to a contradiction in conception? Well, notice how Kant phrases this question, right? He said, how would things stand if my maxim became a universal law? And then he gives his commentary, right? I then see straight away that this maxim can never rank as a universal law of nature and be self-consistent, but must necessarily contradict itself. For the universality of a law that everyone, believing himself to be in need, can make any promise he pleases with the intention not to keep it, would make promising, and the very purpose of promising, itself impossible, right? So there's some kind of inherent contradiction involved, right? So what does that look like in the real world? Well, look, essentially Kant is saying this, right? Imagine that everyone were making promises to pay money back and then actually didn't pay the money back. Well, it would make it very hard to get money, right? No one would believe us anymore, right? If you did this long enough and often enough, right? Lending institutions, banks, for example, or, you know, friends of yours wouldn't believe you, right? They'd feel like you're lying to them, right? Because everyone's lying to them about borrowing and paying back money. So in a world where everyone is lying about paying back money, it's very hard for you to get the money you want, right? Okay, so you've seen this before, right? This is, again, essentially the cheating feature that Kant had described earlier. Okay, so let's talk about three different ways we might interpret Kant here. We might think, first of all, that he's interested in bad results, right? When he asks, how would things stand if my maxim became a universal law? One natural or fairly natural interpretation is just to think, well, look, if everyone were to behave in the way that I'm going to behave, the results of that behavior applied universally would be terrible. Right? So Kant is concerned with bad results, after all, right? And essentially, this is how utilitarians have interpreted Kant, unfortunately. Now, Kant himself did not want to be understood in this way, and we have to make that very clear. And it's probably not the best interpretation of Kant to be had. Right? A slightly better interpretation is to think that Kant is concerned with literal impossibility or some kind of logical contradiction. When I imagine this possible world in which everyone is behaving in the way that I want to behave, right, and there's some kind of contradiction in conception, what Kant is after is some kind of literal impossibility, right? Now, think about it. In this sense, if your motivations are inherently contradictory, then it's probably a good reason to think about your motivations for performing some action, right? So this isn't a bad way to go. And it's not a bad interpretation of Kant, although I don't think it's the best interpretation. The best interpretation, I think, comes from a woman by the name of Christine Korsgaard. She teaches at Harvard. She's a Kantian, right? Kant scholar. And she talks about a practical contradiction, right? Rather than a logical contradiction or a literal impossibility, she prefers to think about what Kant is after in terms of a practical contradiction. Okay, so here, think about the motivations of the person that goes into a bank trying to borrow money, all the while knowing he can't pay the money back. Well, he makes a promise to pay the money back, knowing he can't. But the reason for that is because he wants to make things easier on himself, right? His goal is to obtain money. And without lying, he's not going to be able to get that money. So he lies in order to make things easier on himself. However, when he universalizes his lying maxim, right, when he imagines a world in which everyone is telling lies about paying back money, in that world, he's made it harder on himself to actually get that money, right? Which Kant says is a practical contradiction. What you wanted was to make things easier on yourself, but after you universalize your maxim, you've now made things far more difficult on yourself, right? You can't get money once your maxim becomes universalized. So Kant says this is a practical contradiction. And as Korsgaard argues, I agree with her that it's the best interpretation of what Kant had in mind. So some kind of practical contradiction is at work, right? What I want is to make things easier on myself, and I lie in order to do that. But once I universalize my lying maxim, or in this case, my false promise to pay money back, what happens is, in that imagined world, I've now made it more difficult for myself to get money. So it's practically inconsistent, right? Okay, so let's go on to the second example that Kant provides. Now in this case, he's dealing with suicide. And Kant wants to ask the question, is it possible to universalize a suicidal maxim? Now, as I said earlier, I don't think this is one of the better examples that Kant provides, and actually I'm not sure that it really does lead to a contradiction in conception, but we'll consider Kant's argument nonetheless. So here's what he has to say. In fact, this is the first example Kant provides. And there are some interesting things to glean from this example too. So number one, a man feels sick of life as the result of a series of misfortunes that has mounted to the point of despair. But he is still so far in possession of his reason as to ask himself whether taking his own life may not be contrary to his duty to himself. Right? Should he take his own life or not? He now applies the test. Notice that he calls the formula of universal law a test. Right? And he asks the question, can the maxim of my action really become a universal law of nature? Kant continues. His maxim is, from self-love, I make it my principle to shorten my life if its continuance threatens more evil than it promises pleasure. So there's the maxim again. Kant continues, the only further question is to ask whether this principle of self-love can become a universal law of nature. It is then seen at once that a system of nature by whose law the very same feeling whose function is to stimulate the furtherance of life should actually destroy life, would contradict itself, and consequently could not subsist as a system of nature. Hence, this maxim cannot possibly hold as a universal law of nature, and is therefore entirely opposed to the supreme principle of all duty. Okay. So according to Kant, it is never morally permissible to commit suicide. Right? Now that's the question. Now, I have to ask here, and I always spend a little bit of time on this issue, with my students in a traditional classroom setting. Are there good reasons for committing suicide? Now, no doubt some of you will immediately think, no, there are no good reasons for committing suicide. Right? But I have to say, I'm not sure I agree with that. I think there may be good reasons for committing suicide. Essentially what we're asking is it ever rational to commit suicide? Right? Now, of course, you know, if I break up with my, I'll tell you a story about my, you know, I used to date a girl named Jennifer. Back in, I was probably 16 years old at the time. Now, Jennifer, of course, broke up with me, and I was terribly hurt by that, right? My first serious girlfriend, I had, I think I kissed a girl one time before that. But at any rate, Jennifer broke up with me, didn't want to hang out with me anymore. I was devastated at 16, you know. And, to be honest, thought for a long time about committing suicide as a 16-year-old. Now when I reflect back on that, I think that's absolutely ridiculous, right? But, you know, as a 16-year-old, I really did contemplate suicide for a little while after Jennifer broke up with me. So, of course, we don't want people committing suicide in conditions like that, right? We think in conditions like that, yeah, it's irrational for people to commit suicide. But of course, just as there can be bad reasons for committing suicide, we imagine, or it may be possible to imagine, that there might be good reasons for committing suicide, right? Now, of course, good reasons for committing suicide are going to be few and far between. But that's not to say that there can't be any reason for committing suicide whatsoever. Right? So we have to be careful. Now, Kant denies that there are any good reasons for committing suicide, which seems to me a little extreme. And I want to just say that there must be conditions under which suicide can be rational. Right? If I'm suffering terminally ill and suffering from cancer, and the doctors say I'm going to live for the next 3 months, but those 3 months are going to be outrageously painful, and I won't even be able to string together a coherent sentence. I won't really be able to enjoy time with family members. You know, I'll be vomiting and they're trying to save me using chemo or whatever. And so under conditions like that, it may be rational to commit suicide. Now, one response may be, well, maybe there is something that I need to learn from, remaining alive in these last hours of my life. Well, I don't know that that's the case, right? I don't know that there's anything really to learn, right, from, gratuitous suffering. At least as far as I'm concerned, it seems that, committing suicide, at least in a very narrow range of cases, may indeed be rational. Although, I would certainly agree with those of you who think that in most cases, suicide is probably not the best course of action. Okay, so with that said, let's move on to the next example. Now, those two cases, right, the lying promise case, or the, not the lying promise, but the, what was it? The false promise case, right, lying to get money. That was the first case that we read, and then the suicide case, those are both examples of what Kant calls contradictions in conception, which are perfect duties. He doesn't think they admit of exceptions, right? And maybe some of you agree with him. The last two examples he provides are different, right? These lead to contradictions in will, not to contradictions in conception, and as such, they are concerned with not violations of perfect duties, but violations of imperfect duties. Now, I said earlier that an imperfect duty is an obligation that doesn't meet all of the time, right? Either it may admit of exceptions, or the way I go about meeting those obligations is really a matter of personal preference, right? So let's see. I'm going to start with the fourth example, and then we'll read the third one last. So this example is about a man who is wealthy, and he determines that he doesn't want to help anyone else, right? He wants to be left alone, and he doesn't want to be expected to help anyone else. And Kant wants to know if I could will a maxim of non-aid, essentially, right? By non-aid, I mean non-assistance, right? Okay, so let me read it. He says this, right? Yet a fourth is himself flourishing, right? But he sees others who have to struggle with great hardships, and whom he could easily help. And he thinks, what does it matter to me? Let everyone be as happy as heaven wills, or as he can make himself. I won't deprive him of anything. I won't even envy him. Only I have no wish to contribute anything to his well-being or to his support in distress. Kant continues, now admittedly, if such an attitude were a universal law of nature, mankind could get on perfectly well. Right? Notice, there is no contradiction in conception, in other words, right? Better, no doubt, than if everybody prates about sympathy and goodwill and even takes pains on occasion to practice them, but on the other hand, cheats where he can, traffics in human rights, or violates them in other ways. But although it is possible that a universal law of nature could subsist in harmony with this maxim, yet it is impossible to will that such a principle should hold everywhere as a law of nature. Okay, so now it's getting interesting. What does he say? But although it is possible, he says, I'm reading this for a second time, right, that a universal law of nature could subsist in harmony with this maxim, yet it is impossible to will right? Now it's a contradiction in will, not contradiction in conception. Impossible to will that such a principle could hold everywhere as a law of nature. So what's the explanation of why that is? Kant continues, for a will which decided in this way would be in conflict with itself, since many a situation might arise in which the man needed love and sympathy from others, and in which, by such a law of nature, sprung from his own will, he would rob himself of all hope of the help he wants for himself. Okay. Well, I hope that that wasn't too complicated. Let's try to parse this out and understand what he's saying. So he says it doesn't lead to a contradiction in conception, but it does lead to a contradiction in will, and that's why it remains an obligation to help other human beings, right? The reason is, Kant seems to think that if I refuse to help other human beings, and I imagine that it's now become a universal law that no one should help anyone else, I would rob myself of any assistance that I would possibly need from another human being. After all, if it's a universal law that we not help anyone, then I couldn't get help from anyone. Right? So Kant thinks that there's no way to will that such a maxim should become a universal law, because I would rob myself of any assistance that I might need in some kind of situation. Well, we might imagine some kind of different scenario, right? I mean, look, given the empirical facts about ourselves, that I'm not omnipotent, right? Omnipotent means all-powerful, right? I'm not all-powerful, so it seems that I'm going to need help from someone, right? And given the fact that I need help, it would make no sense to will such a maxim to become a universal law, right? Well, look, what we could do is imagine someone who is like a rugged individualist, right? The rugged individualist says, I don't need help from anyone, and if I ever did need help, I'd simply go without, right? I don't want help from anyone. And the question is, could such a person will a maxim of non-aid, right? Or a maxim of indifference to other human beings, right? Well, we might think about this for a moment, right? Think about the rugged individualist as a baby. Isn't it the case that a baby needs help from its mother? Right? And at one point, the rugged individualist was a baby and did get help from his mother, right? And so if it became a universal law that no one should help anyone else, then mothers couldn't help babies, in which case the rugged individualist would still have robbed himself of the assistance that he or she received from his or her mother, right? Well, that's one way we could respond to the rugged individualist. Here's a second, even more clever way of responding to the rugged individualist. Imagine that you pull up behind this person on the highway, right? And they've got a flat tire. And you don't know this yet, but it's the rugged individualist, right? And he's changing his tire. And you walk up there and you say, hey, can I give you a hand? And he tells you to get the hell out of here, right? Get out of here, I don't need your help. What are you gonna do? Are you gonna say, come hell or high water, I'm gonna help you change that tire? Probably not, right? You're going to cooperate with him in some sense. You're going to follow his instructions, right? He tells you to get lost, and that's what you do. You get back in your car and you drive away. Well, this is a form of assistance, right? You're cooperating with him. You're granting him his wish in some sense, right? So he tells you to get lost and you leave, right? You're not going to fight with him so you can change his tire. You're going to cooperate with him and leave, right? And of course, cooperation is a form of assistance. So even here, we have a response for the rugged individualist, and it seems that Kant is right to say we can't will maxims of non-aid. And I think he's right about that. Okay, that's the fourth example. Let me read, we're kind of, as I said, we're reading these out of order. I'm going to read the last example, but it's actually the third example. So in this case, Kant is asking questions about developing our talents and whether or not we have obligations to develop the talents that we have. And Kant seems to think that we do have obligations to at least pursue some of the talents that we have, if not all. So let me read the passage. He says this, "A third finds in himself a talent whose cultivation would make him a useful man for all sorts of purposes. But he sees himself in comfortable circumstances, and he prefers to give himself up to pleasure rather than to bother about increasing or improving his fortunate natural aptitudes. Yet he asks himself further, does my maxim of neglecting my natural gifts, besides agreeing in itself with my tendency to indulgence, agree also with what is called duty? He then sees that a system of nature could indeed always subsist under such a universal law. Right? Again, no contradiction in conception. Kant continues, right? Although every man should let his talents rust and should be bent on devoting his life solely to idleness, indulgence, procreation, and in a word, to enjoyment. Only he cannot possibly will, right? Again, this is an emphasis on the contradiction in will, not the contradiction in conception. Only he cannot possibly will that this should become a universal law of nature, or should be implanted in us as such a law by a natural instinct. For as a rational being, he necessarily wills that all his powers should be developed, since they serve him, and are given him for all sorts of possible ends. Okay. So Kant seems to suggest here that we have an obligation to develop our talents, and that we couldn't will it to become universal law that none of us developed our talents. Now, why is that? Well, it's an interesting question. And again, like the suicide example, again, I think this idea that we have to develop some of our talents is a less clear example of what Kant is after. It's not nearly as clear as our obligation to help others, to assist others, right? But the idea that I have an obligation to develop my talents, Kant is less clear about how that is all to be laid out. So what we might say is this, right? That I can't will a world where no one develops their talents, because that would lead to a contradiction in will, right? It would mean that no one developed their talents, in which case we'd just all be idle, couch potatoes. And we wouldn't have couches, essentially, right? We wouldn't have anything. We'd be eating, pineapple or whatever, or we'd simply die off. So we've got to develop some of the talents we have, because we've got to eat, right? So some of us develop talents, agricultural talents. Some of us are able to hunt, and of course we continue to specialize, and we develop industry, right? And you have the progression of society through specialization, right? And so maybe that's what Kant has in mind. It's hard to say what Kant has in mind precisely, but that may be something like what he's thinking. Okay, so where does that leave us? Well, those are the four examples that Kant provides, and I think I've given you enough in this lecture to think about. So very shortly, I'll have the next lecture up as well. So talk to you soon, I guess.